Morality seems universal, guiding our actions and shaping our societies. But what happens when cultures clash and moral codes contradict? Welcome to this episode on moral relativism.
Hey everybody, welcome to Open Door Philosophy. I'm one of your two hosts today, Derek Parsons.
And I'm the second of the two hosts, Andrew. I don't have a cool title this week, actually.
Okay. The Saint.
The Moral Saint.
The Moral Saint. yeah. Taylor is surviving finals, so Taylor is out on assignment, as we say.
Yeah, y'all had such a cool introduction last week where you conveniently left me out and then you recognized that I wasn't talking, and so I wish that I was that creative, but that's okay. Okay.
It's okay. That was off the dome, as the kids like
was
to say.
Was it really?
Yeah. That was not planned.
That's cool. Yeah.
We'll see if I have such creative energy today.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I cannot believe that we've never talked about this topic before we do our introductions. That's like the first thing that stands out to me. I cannot believe we've never done this topic.
Oh, yeah.
But anyways, how's it going?
Yeah. I have a real beef with it, so this will be fun. Oh, it's going fine. It is raining, as it is a customary for this time of year in Houston. So,
yeah, but that's almost like an understatement. It's like...
Yeah, I know. Yeah, this time of year, I mean, I keep going back through that. Conveniently, all these social medias tell me what my memories are. That's mm-hmm. a philosophical issue. But, you know, it seems like half of them this time of year, it's like, oh, well, here's some flood photos of, you know, whenever. So... Lots of flooding this time of year. I got to tell you, Houston does many things well, but one of the things it does not do well is flood management. So, and that's not so much in the city; it's largely in the more rural area, outlying areas, East Texas right now. From here to Louisiana is just like literally swamped.
Yeah, I'm curious though. Any city that gets this much water, are they actually good at? Maybe like countries that get monsoons, but I feel like there's probably better cities. I was going to try to be a Houston defendant, but it seems like our water, we get so much water, and then it seems like when it rains, the raindrops are so much bigger. I don't know. Maybe not.
East Texas is very good at rain. That's what it's really good at. It will rain for days, and it will be really big, heavy rain. Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah. I don't know. I guess an American city we could point to is maybe New Orleans, but even that goes south from time to time.
Yeah.
I don't know. You got to like contact the Dutch or something. Aren't they the one with all the like the expert engineers on dikes or?
I don't know.
Isn't half their country under sea level or something?
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
Talking
out of my range. Anyway, I'm fine. I have jury duty tomorrow, so we'll see how that goes.
Civic duties.
Yeah. So many duties. So moral. You know, an obligation. Anyway, how are you?
I'm doing good. I'm surviving the rain, and that's about it. Nothing too exciting. And so I listened to this episode that came out the last when I wasn't on there, and I heard you guys talking about this Taylor Swift album. And I just wanted to say, so I'm going to say it now, you guys, it's like you can blink twice and say you don't like it. I mean, this was the worst album by far. Okay. you can own up to it and admit it. I can say that.
Well, yeah, you can say that.
I can say that. You guys can say that too, but that's my only opinion.
I will say it. It is the least favorite of the Taylor Swift albums. Yeah, it doesn't mean that there aren't some songs on it that I like. I mean, there are some songs on it that I like. But, you know, in its totality, yeah, it's just not my fave.
It's fair. Okay. That's a respectable opinion. Something has to be last, even if you think it's all great.
That's true. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see where it's going. I'm hoping the trajectory of musical style there for Miss Swift takes a different direction next album. But it's fine. It'll probably, you know, in the great scope of things, let's say she puts out 20 albums. I mean, it'll fit nicely into the catalog.
Well, you know, sometimes people just have to, I was going to use a worse analogy, a more Texas analogy. Sometimes you just have to know, you know, something good is over, I think. And maybe this is it, and maybe she has more, and but you never know, I guess, as an artist.
Well, the bubble has to pop at some point. It's been a crazy last 2 years for her as far as success goes. So, but anyway, so, let us move on.
But anyway, this is our first episode, just you and me, and about a, I think, more than a year.
A long time.
Where it's just,
more than a year. Yeah, a year and a half, maybe.
I want to celebrate this reunion with a game that I came up with. Okay.
Back to Andrew's games. You're like the puzzle master or whatever the saw guy is. What's his name? Jigsaw.
I don't know. I've never seen it. I know the mask. That's much more like a, I don't know what the word is here. That's much more superior. I was thinking of the jester, the court jester, you know, with the balls. So I guess that's a much more protagonist or antagonist view.
You know,
I got to
keep it. I got to keep it edgy.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen the first Saw movie like, I don't know, 15 years ago or something.
I thought you were going to say 15 times first.
No,
wow, no, that's
not my.
That's
not my genre. It's not my genre. I don't like horror movies at all.
Yeah,
I'm like, reality is horrific enough. I don't need I don't need movies to make it any worse.
Yeah, I think the closest thing I'll go to horror is sci-fi, and that really freaks me out, so I stay far away. Anyways, okay, so this game that I have, it's kind of like a would you rather, but philosophy style, and I think I know some of these, and I think our listeners will know where you fall on these, but so I'm not as curious on the side that you pick, is more of the explanations of why.
Okay.
So, two scenarios.
Okay.
We have three groups of two. Okay, so first grouping. Would you rather, one, live in a world where your actions are predetermined, but you believe that you have free will, or you live in a world with true free will, but you're unsure of, you know, if it's, if you have free will or not?
I see. Well, gosh, I think it doesn't matter. I mean, if I have the illusion of free will, then I think I have free will. So, you know, from a practical standpoint, I guess it doesn't really matter. From a, I guess a purist or something type of standpoint, I would say, I'd rather live in a world with true free will, whether I realize I have it or not. I guess that's my answer. If that's an answer. I don't know.
Yeah,
what do you think?
I think that's an answer. Well, the party pooper in me wants to say, well, you know, the first possibility can't exist, but, and so it's a non sequitur or whatever. But I think I more or less agree with you, and I'd probably pick the second where we do have true free will. We have not yet done an episode. I don't think we've done one, but I feel like we have. But I don't
on
think
free
we've
will?
Done it on free will yet. Or have we just talked about it a lot?
I'm sure. Oh, no doubt we've talked about it a lot. I don't know if we've done one just like straight free will. I have to look back through the catalog.
Yeah, that would be a fun one to do. And I think what's more interesting too with that is like, what are the implications if we have free will and if we don't, especially in ethics? Let's look at a second grouping of scenarios. Okay. And I know, I think I know which one you're going to pick, but okay. So would you rather possess absolute knowledge about the universe in the future, but you lose the ability to experience surprise and wonder? Or would you rather have limited knowledge and live with uncertainty, but you can still have the ability to learn and discover and be surprised?
Well, I think I'd choose choice number two. Unfortunately, what comes along with that is, you know, this is relatively positive things. You retain the ability to learn, discover, and be surprised. Being surprised does not necessarily entail the thing that you are surprised about is positive. You could be like, hi, doctor. Oh, hello, patient. By the way, you have stage 4 cancer. Oh, crap. Right. So that's not a good type of surprise. But I do hope that there is a wonder and beauty in the world to be discovered. That makes, I feel like that gives life a little more zest. Yeah, I think I'd still go with choice number two. How about you? Or do I need to say more about that?
No, I think that's great. I think I would probably rather pick choice number two as well. I think that just part of being a human is not knowing about a lot of things. And I think if we were robbed by that, we wouldn't be human. I'm a human. And so I think if I was fundamentally altered, I would not be the same thing. So I think I would also pick number two. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of life. Even those dark surprises, I think.
No, it's true. I mean, that's, yeah, even with the dark surprises, that is what makes life meaningful, I say, with a Dr. Evil pinky indicating existentialism. But let me say a little more follow-up on that, actually. So I teach a lot of philosophies of life in my course, and a lot of them end up with this notion of equanimity or tranquility of mind, non-attachment to results, and all these types of things. And many, many philosophies advocate for that. And I feel like that's kind of like position one here in a way. Because one of my questions or criticisms, and certainly my students have the same criticism, is like, okay, well, non-attachment is great. And, you know, having a tranquil mind or a peaceful mind, it also sounds wonderful. But, you know, that also means you have a peaceful, tranquil mind during really happy, you know, enthusiastic moments. And it seems to kind of take the zest out of life. Of course, you want a peaceful mind during tragic moments. But, you know, it goes both ways.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Okay, so last one. I'm going to throw an audible here and change it up a little bit. Okay. Would you rather live forever, but you can't die? Or would you rather live a normal human life, but eventually die?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know my answer to this one. I'd want to die.
Yeah.
Now, why do I think this is a good question? Thank you for asking. I have been around enough really old people who are going to die within, you know, 5 years or even sooner than that. And I mean old, like in their 90s. And they're kind of like, you know what? I've kind of done this thing. So ready to move on. And they're like totally peaceful with that idea. So kind of based on that, I'm like, okay, well, you must get tired of all this. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. I think the idea of living forever scares me. There's this movement that corresponds with philosophy and with science right now called transhumanism.
Oh, yeah.
And the goal behind transhumanism is, I'm sure there's a lot of goals, but one of the goals is that to develop a system where you could potentially upload your consciousness and live forever in a computer or something of this sort. And this idea, I think, it is attractive to a lot of people, but one of those is not me. And so,
I was going to say, I think there's something to be said for experience, you know, being a self-aware being, that there's something to that about being embodied, right? I don't know exactly what that is, but it seems like if I just had a abstract consciousness without being embodied in any sort of way, I don't know what that experience would be like. It doesn't seem like it would be as rich or full, but
I agree.
Yeah, I don't know. I think
I don't want to toe this line too much, and I think maybe I have a tendency to do it, but I think that human beings aren't just, you know, they're not just their consciousness in a way. And so if we rob ourselves of our body, it's robbing ourselves as the essential elements of ourselves as human beings. And so would that be a particularly good existence to be robbed of our very selves? And I'm not sure about that. I mean, the body is essential to our nature. And so is death. It's like the one constant. And so we rob ourselves of either of those two things. It's it's like taking coldness out of a property of a cube, an ice cube. It seems just like radically transformative.
That's interesting. I think a really good modern thought experiment on this comes from the world of Star Trek. And there's a character named Data. Next generation fans will know this. I guess it's a reboot. Anyway, the show Picard, the first season of it, which came out a few years ago, Data resumes his role, and exactly what you're talking about is what's going on. Like, his consciousness can be uploaded because he's an android, but he wants to die. you know? Mm. It was really fascinating. He wants that experience of death. And if you watch that entire show, you know, Data often deals with these things that make us human.
Yeah.
And always seeking those things. And anyway, the writers of the show obviously come to the conclusion that Data would not want his consciousness to exist forever. And if there's anyone who could ever pull it off, it's him, because he's an android.
All right, let's move into the topic of the episode. Enough jesterly game master games.
Did I win?
I think you won. You win yes. a free ice cream cone.
I love ice cream. Wait, just the cone?
Only if you upload your consciousness, you'll get the ice cream. Yeah.
Oh, man. But I couldn't taste it because I would not have a body.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be really odd.
Yeah. What a prize. Thank you.
Yeah.
Anytime. What a gift.
Yeah. So this is just, you can also receive your free ice cream cone if you subscribe to our newsletter.
Oh, yes.
But you can only receive it if you upload your consciousness. You can subscribe to our podcast newsletter if you go down to the description of this episode, either on YouTube, wherever you listen to podcasts. I think if you go to our website, you can also do so. You can email us for a link. There's a multitude of ways to subscribe to the newsletter. We just released another one, and so if you subscribe sometime this month, you will get an introductory newsletter welcome email along with this month's email. Do that now. Send us an email and let us know what you think of it.
Yeah, everybody go do it. And especially for next month, I'm up in the rotation. And no doubt that's I right. will have some spicy takes on things.
Well, that's a really relative statement, you know.
Okay. Nice segue.
Yeah, I try.
Well, segue on, man.
This episode, we are going to be covering this topic known as moral relativism, which stems off from a bunch of different avenues in philosophy, especially from, it's kind of a combination of epistemology and ethics. And so I cannot believe, like I said at the beginning of this episode, that we have not covered this, because moral relativism is one of the, I mean, it's a question that has gone way, way back in philosophy, and we'll talk mm-hmm. about that. But it's also a really culturally prevalent topic right now and mm-hmm. has been for past 100 years or so. So I think it's a really pertinent question for us to talk about, regardless of your opinions on the subject.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. I think it is an incredibly relevant topic to talk about. It falls under metaethics. You know, if you study ethics, it's actually one of my, when I think about the different ethics that I teach, this is the one I actually feel least prepared for or least confident in. So really? It'll be, I mean, yeah, I don't know why. Metaethics is the one where I always feel like I'm just a little bit on shaky ground. But anyway, we'll see how it goes. I'm excited to talk about it.
Here's a few key questions that we're going to be talking about today that encompass the system of moral relativism. First, can morality be entirely relative to an individual or cultural standard? Does the diversity of moral beliefs across cultures undermine the existence of objective moral principles? Does the fact that human sacrifice exists in one culture, and that's seen as something that's positive and necessary for the society to function, does the fact that that exists in one culture, but that's looked down upon in another, disprove the fact that there's objective morals?
Yeah.
And then finally, if everything is in fact relative, how do we reconcile conflicting moral judgments and prevent mm-hmm. moral chaos?
Yeah, good questions. Those are tough.
Important questions too, I think. Mm-hmm. I think a first good question for us both is maybe let's lay our cards out on the table.
Mm.
When is the first time that you've experienced or talked about or heard of this concept of moral relativism?
Oh, well, that's interesting. I have to go way back for me. For me, I have to go way back. Geez, I don't know. Okay, I think maybe I have an idea. So we've talked a lot about religion in the last couple episodes. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a particular religious tradition, Churches of Christ. I don't know if it was ever told to me, but there was definitely this clear notion that other religions would not make it into heaven. And that also applied to other Christian denominations. And I remember being a kid driving to church, and at some point, you know, it dawned on me as we're driving past these other churches. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. this applies to these people, right? The heroes, these, what are Methodists? I don't know. I'm a kid. But I'm like, but I know that that has a different title than my church. And so maybe that's the first, that's at least an early one for me when I realized, you know, there can be differences in moral conceptions. I mean, what's more moral than, you know, getting into heaven? So I don't know. What about you?
I asked the question and don't have an immediate answer. That's always a bad sign. I don't know if this was the first, but I think one of the big deals with this was growing up in a time when the U.S. was heavily involved in the Middle East, and we could see a lot of values that these different cultures held.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it's quite occurring, the ideas maybe of jihad and of rights of women and things. And it wasn't necessarily a religious question, but a question of values that the West held, that these different countries held too. And I think that we often painted them as the bad guys and for doing these things and for limiting these principles. And maybe that's true. I mean, this is not right, the purpose for this, but the thing that was clear to me is that these people didn't see themselves as the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And they didn't, I mean, they don't think what they're doing is wrong. And so that was the first time that I think I thought of these things.
Yeah, that's a great example. You know, at some point in education, it's just going to strike children. It's like, oh, there are people that are different than I am.
Yep.
So whether you're sitting in third grade learning about the first Thanksgiving, you're like, why are these people wearing belt buckles on their hats? You know, you're like, that's a weird thing to do. I know it's not necessarily cultural relativism, but it's probably the first exposure we have, maybe as we're growing up, is like what we see, right? Rather than something like ideology, we see that there are differences in how people dress. And that is a cultural thing. That's nothing to do with morality per se, unless the dress does have something to do with morality.
Yeah. So we'll start to go over some philosophers in a second, but there's a varying degrees of moral relativism, and we don't want to misconstrue people who hold the position as we want to be charitable to them. There's two types. Well, I'm sure there's more than two types, but there's two standard types of moral relativism that one often holds in a philosophical community. First is an observation more than a claim about morality. And I think we probably both hold this. And this is called descriptive relativism. And descriptive relativism makes a simple claim, and that's an observation that moral codes vary across different cultures. Mm-hmm. And so this is just the descriptive side. And then there's a step up from that, which is we could title prescriptive relativism, which is a further claim, which states that these variations across moral cultures mean that all moral judgments are equally valid, making it impossible to objectively judge another culture's morality.
Yeah,
there's quite a difference there between the two. One can hold the first without holding the second, but if one holds the second, they must hold the first. What's your thoughts about this?
Well, regarding cultural relativity, so I don't know exactly what I believe to be true. I know what I want to believe to be true. And that is that there is some objective morals that exists in the universe.
Yep.
But here's where the when we're talking about prescriptive versus descriptive, the leap that bothers me here is that, you know, just because there are cultures that have differing moral beliefs or similar beliefs, right? That doesn't really prove anything. That doesn't disprove moral objectivity. What it suggests is that, like, some cultures may be deeply misguided in what they think is morally permissible, but I don't see any correlation really between those two. I think it's just too big of a leap.
I was going to bring this up, and I was worried that a disagreement might arise, but I don't know why I thought that. But I think that's right. Just because a different culture holds something doesn't mean it's right. I think we can imagine someone who would believe that, who would think that the jump is... Who might believe that jump is not as big of a cavern as we think it is. Mm-hmm. Why might they believe that?
Well, I mean, the simple answer is probably because I don't think there's any objective morality. I don't know what the argument is for saying that the fact that different cultures hold different moral values. I don't understand what the justification is for saying, and that proves that I don't know how we get there or how they get there. A thing I do think is kind of interesting about all this is this does kind of create a dichotomy for me when I'm thinking about this, which is, do all moral values, does it have to be 100%? You know, are there moral values that can be culturally bound and that's okay? For instance, well, you know, when we talk about objective morality, although I think there are some things that are objectively morally true, right or wrong, but I think that list is pretty limited. And so, you know, if one culture holds that a particular type of marriage arrangement is morally right, do you see where I'm getting at with this? Does everything that seems to be a moral decision, does that have to, if some are culture bound, does that completely negate, you know, objective morality? But
yeah,
I'm probably taking on a road you didn't expect us to mean for us to go.
No, I'm very sorry. No, that's fine. That's great. So I think that there's a few positions that one can take from this kind of meta-ethical standpoint on this question. I think that one can claim that there is universal, absolute moral truth that are instituted and in place by either some kind of concept or by a god or something of this sort. And I think that's one position. And so if that is instituted, then I don't know if we can hold that same position. I think that really the strictness of the list would depend upon either that very that ethical conceptualization that exists in the universe or God or something. And so if one culture is completely following those set of ideas, however they happen to do that, then we could say, okay, that list is however long it is.
All right.
And I'm not sure if that's the case, but we could also have a second one, which a second kind of conceptualization, which maybe there is a concept of right and wrong in the universe, and one can, in different cultures, kind of shoot an arrow and they land somewhere along the target. And so some cultures get things right, some cultures get things wrong, but it's really difficult to know which cultures are right and wrong. But there is some right and wrong that exist, and cultures need to figure this out in some kind of way. And then I think there's a final position that we can hold, which is that there is no objective right and wrong in the universe. And that's where I think things can get kind of slippery.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by slippery is I think that we could say, okay, there's a right and wrong that we can get by human reason, by these principles or matter of fact, where we can say that there's just no right and wrong in general. And so we can take a number of positions, I think, on that last point, which we'll explore today, I think. I have four philosophical figures that I think we can briefly talk about. The first one is, I think, the first person in the West who advances some kind of concept of moral relativity. This comes from this philosopher named Protagoras, who is a pre-Socratic philosopher in the Hellenistic world. And he has this very famous quote that's been preserved through all time, which is, "Man is the measure of all things." I think we've talked about this quote on here before, haven't we?
Perhaps. You know, we're getting so deep in how many episodes we've done over the years. It's hard for me to recall specifics. Yeah, I don't know. Perhaps.
Yeah. So what do you think about this quote, "Man is the measure of all things"?
Doesn't Shakespeare have a similar quote? I'm sure he was referencing Protagoras. Write us in and tell us, people.
Yeah.
What do I think of it? So it's really funny. On one hand, I'm like, yes, I love that. Because there's so much about beauty and art and all these things that seem very human to me, you know, like, yes, man is the measure of these things. And I can certainly see how, the Renaissance thinkers would have picked up on this idea with humanism and like, yes, man is the measure of all things. But you're right. There's more to it than just that. And it does have an ethical dimension, right? And that's that human beings also create morality. We're the measure of that as well. That's kind of where I'm at. I do like the quote. It's very great for, beginning conversations.
100%. Last time we talked about this quote, I think we had like a list of five philosophy quotes or something way back a long time ago. And I think when we were doing our quote review, I think
we the both, quote corner.
Yeah, the quote corner.
R.I.P.
I think we both. It'll come back eventually. I think it'll be raised from the dead.
That's right. Our 100th episode. We'll just do nothing but bits.
Yeah. we're gonna get there, and then we're gonna have to do it. Okay. I think we both highlighted this word "all" that exists at the end of the quote of all things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for some things, I think that this has to be absolutely true. Man is the measure of all things. Okay. So I was at HEB yesterday, and we're recording this on Cinco de Mayo. And so
that's right. It's Cinco de Mayo.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
We should have a special theme. Okay. So this mariachi band was playing in the front of the store yesterday.
Yeah.
And so to me, I don't know anything about the great mariachi tradition. And so I thought, okay, well, they're pretty good. They're fine. But if somebody else came in who is an expert mariachi player or, you know, knows all of the significance of the mariachi, they might say, well, you know, the outfits aren't exactly right, or, you know, the violinist didn't come in at the right time, or maybe they're actually absolutely great. But I guess the way that we measure their goodness or how great of mariachi they were, it really changes depending on who's making that observation and that inference in the moment. But to say this about, hopefully, both of us agree, and I think we do, that, you know, the extermination of the Jews in 1940s Europe was a bad thing. But the fact that some in Germany thought, you know, okay, this is going to actually help and advance our society back in the day, thought that was a good. I just feel like that's not a good and very compelling thing to say in that moment. That just because, you know, we're measuring things differently, for them it's right since they think it's a good. For me, I think it's a bad. For us, we think it's a bad. And so it's really up to the individual. I'm not really convinced by that.
Well, you know, there are some things that are morally neutral, right? For instance, we could be or like mariachi. I mean, I don't know if there's anything necessarily moral about mariachi bands.
Yeah.
Or we could say the same about chocolate cake, you know. This is a delicious, you know, watching the British Bake Off, you know, and Paul's like, ah, this is delicious. Yeah. And Prue's like, oh, it's stodgy. And, you know, whatever. Like, there's no morality in this. Man is literally the measure of this chocolate cake.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you like my reference there? I'm trying to be relevant, you know, talking about popular shows, which I don't even know if that's popular. But.
Well, I think the popularity of that is relative in itself.
Oh, yes, indeed. Indeed. Yeah. Right. So it's morally neutral, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's moral at all.
But, you know, murder or genocide is not morally neutral.
Yeah. I think this is where we can be slippery on this topic of relativism as a whole. Mm-hmm. Things are relative. Even the person who's going to say objectively, I think that they would say there's a lot of things that are relative in the world that depend upon you and your taste and your preferences. For morality, we can say that things are moral and still hold that you like pepperoni on pizza and Jim down the street doesn't like pepperoni on pizza, and both of you are right.
No, Jim is wrong. I love pepper. You know, every time we get together where my parents live, the town I grew up in, Tulsa, you know, we always like to get pizza from this one place. And every time we're there, we get pizza from this one place because it's the best.
Yeah.
And everyone likes these weird, you know, combinations of stuff you can, toppings and everything. And I'm just like, can I please just have a pepperoni pizza? And they all look at me like I'm nuts, you know.
Yeah.
They're like, just pepperoni? I'm like, well, obviously cheese and sauce too. I mean, they're like, you're mad. I'm like, no, this is as good. Like, it can't get any better than this.
Yeah.
Anyway, very relative.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
So Protagoras, what he should have said was, man is the measure of many things.
I thought you were going to say man is the measure of chocolate cake or something.
Well, I think
of pepperoni pizza. Yeah.
Of pepperoni pizza.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Well, wait. I know you want to move on to something important, but you're Italian. So how do you feel about pepperoni pizza?
I guess it's fine. I mean, I guess it's
fine. I want
fine.
Some they strong have, views here.
Come yeah, on. I don't have strong views on this topic. I was going to say, maybe I can sidestep and put this one in for your consideration. I don't know if this is an Italian thing or an Italian-American thing, but everyone in my family who's, you know, Italian and whatever, they love pistachio ice cream. And when I get it, this was like a childhood thing when my grandparents, they loved pistachio ice cream. My aunts and uncles and cousins, it's like their childhood memories, getting pistachio ice cream. And same with me. But then when I go to somebody else and I'm like, oh, I love pistachio ice cream. They're like, what? So how do you feel about pistachio ice cream?
How do I feel about it?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I love anything that's culturally bound when it comes to cuisine. Like if pistachio ice cream or maybe gelato, is this what we're talking about? If that's like something that Italians love, I'm like, I want that too. Like, yeah. I want to try that. I'm intrigued by it. So I'm fine with pistachio ice cream. I think when we were in Italy, we surely had some, that sounds very familiar, some pistachio gelato.
I had it right under the Duomo in Florence.
Oh, did you? Well, then I'm sure we had it. Yeah.
I'm sure. Anyways, enough about food.
Sorry.
I'm getting hungry. No. Too. Let's skip Nietzsche, although we might get some hate comments, unless you want to say something about him.
Well, I think we've talked about Nietzsche already without talking about him. So he has this view called perspectivism. And this is kind of exactly what we're talking about, right? So you have these multiple interpretations of reality, each within its own validity, depending on the perspective of from which it was viewed, like pistachio ice cream or pepperoni pizzas. And I think that's a very important theory to think about. But I think we've already talked about it. But yeah, Nietzsche, I don't know if he used the word perspectivism, but I've more than once read that in multiple places.
I know. I don't know. I'm not a big Nietzsche reader of Nietzsche, but maybe that will change one day. Okay, so I have two philosophers on here who are both contemporary who have wildly opposing thoughts, but are unified in their shared Britishness. Although I know one lived in Australia for quite a time. And we've talked about both of these on the podcast in different things before. J.L. Mackey, we've talked about for his views on religion, philosophy of religion. I think that's what he's most known for, but this is a pretty close second. And so J.L. Mackey, he was a British philosopher in the 20th century. I guess that's all the context for him. But a cool side note that I mentioned before that I just keep bringing out because I have to. His daughter was my ancient Greek teacher, which I think was super cool.
Is cool.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah. And she never told us that, but she would always slip in when I brought up something philosophy related. My dad once discussed this topic with me, and then I put the pins together one time. I am going to raise this topic of, he presents this kind of trifold view argument for why moral relativism is true. He came up with this idea called moral error theory, which is basically this argument that moral judgments that we make in the world are fundamentally mistaken because they assume objective moral properties that just don't exist. Basically, his point here is that if we take away the human being or human society or humans altogether, there's no moral truths that just exist in the universe. Mm. And for us to assume a priori that they exist, if we do assume that, then of course. But if we don't and we look at the truth, then there's no objective moral principles in the universe. And therefore, we should all be moral relativists because these truths don't exist independently outside of humans, which I think is true. If we do assume that there's no moral principles which exist independent of humans, I think we must believe this. Although there are some philosophers who would disagree. Let me give an example here, real quick. Mm-hmm. I don't know, to be honest, if this is morally wrong, but I can imagine that it is. But I'm not a Muslim in any way. I believe that they have this city of Mecca, which is a quite important city to Muslims. I think that destroying that city or the Black Rock would be probably pretty bad and would be seen as pretty morally bad. So we remove all human beings from the universe. They just they disappear tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Every human being disappears. And I don't know why, but maybe the nuclear codes have to be put in every day so they don't all go kaboom. And so one nuclear bomb just happens to drop on the city of Mecca, and the city goes kaboom. Independent of human beings judging this situation happening, would this act be morally wrong. This is such a horrible example, actually. If you have another one.
You've selected something that incredibly significant to a particular culture.
Was the aim. But I don't know if itself is morally... I think I can make the case for it, actually. Like, I don't think we should go around destroying other cultural things that are very important to them, or I don't think that they should be destroyed. I think they should be preserved. So why not?
Agreed.
And so Mackie's point here is that, well, independent of humans, this really wouldn't be a morally bad thing that happens. I think we could also take history as an event on itself. So if all humans go bye-bye tomorrow for whatever reason, nuclear war, or just disappear as a thought experiment, well, he might not want to bring this up, but would the Holocaust have still been wrong?
Yeah.
And it seems intuitively to me, and I'll get your opinion on this, that, this is still wrong, but I don't exactly know why. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so it's like, if we're not here to judge, judge might not even be the word, if we're not here to observe this event, is it objectively morally wrong or right outside of all space and all space and time?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it wouldn't be. So let's take the universe existed before human beings showed up. So as the Earth began to form and we had small, very small microscopic creatures that lived and died, and then they evolve into more sophisticated creatures, but certainly don't have the capacity to reason like human beings do or whatever. Those things lived and died. We weren't around for any of that. Do their deaths, they were eaten by other things, are their deaths wrong or right? Maybe that's a way to look at it, because we weren't there. We weren't there for any of that to happen. I don't know. This is what happens when I come up with examples off
it's the tough. Top of my head. Yeah. It's tough.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, because if you go with a morally objective theory that there are morally objective values in the world of good and bad, then it would be independent of human beings.
Right. Yeah. What might make it even more difficult is the fact that, I don't know, I think the fact that human beings are these creatures who, what is unique to varying degrees among other things that exist in the world, is that human beings have this choice of good and evil and can do good and evil things, but also can recognize good and evil. And so, maybe the antelope getting eaten by the lion in a horrific manner, is that really bad? I don't know. I mean, I'm sure somebody can make a case for it. I don't know. But the fact that Jimmy goes and murders Susie because of whatever reason, I think we could say, I don't know.
I mean, why did I go back to prehistory? Why didn't I just use the antelope and lion example? Thank you for making that much more simple.
Yeah. It's okay. Yeah. I don't know.
Off the dome.
It's off the dome. I love that phrase. There's two things to say about it, and I think both of them can be said better said than myself. A second philosopher, G.E. Moore, who writes an argument in response to Mackie. And the interesting thing about G.E. Moore is that he's actually quite more of an epistemologist than Mackie is, I think. And, and I don't think Mackie's feelings would get hurt, because G.E. Moore, he has this very famous argument for the existence of things actually existing outside of the world, which we've gone over before, which is famous lecture series. He raises his left hand, and then he says, I raise these hands, they exist in the world. And that was all the proof that he needed. It's a 4-page paper. People should check that out. It's actually free, I think, on Phil Papers. It's quite funny. G.E. Moore's argument for against moral relativism. His argument's a little complicated, but I have a nice example about chocolate cake later that will make it all the more sweet. So Moore's argument revolves around this idea of goodness, not really as a thing which stems off of the properties of something, as really of a deeper question which goes past physical properties itself. Okay, and so he's going to say, if we look at a thing's properties, we can say, okay, these properties itself, we can debate if they are alone or good and bad. But the question of, okay, is the object itself good or bad? That still exists, independent after looking of all of these properties. First premise, if good is identical to some natural property, X, then the question, is X itself good, is meaningless. Premise two, the question, is X good, remains a meaningful and open question even after understanding X's natural properties. And then the conclusion that he draws is, therefore, good cannot be identical to any natural properties. And since the question of goodness remains open, it's not remained to another natural property, which is in relative nature to an individual or to a thing. Here's an example that he raises, or not that he raises, but that I try to come up with, but I'm not sure if it will be sufficient to explaining it well. So imagine that we have a piece of cake in front of us that it just looks scrumptious, it tastes really good, it's delicious. We can analyze the various properties that it has naturally. We can analyze its sweetness, how thick the cake is. We can describe its texture. We can describe the rich ingredients that it has. And we can certainly do more than that. But the point that he raises is, even after we fully take all of these properties apart, we can analyze them, we can understand them, the question, is the cake good? That still remains independent upon all of these questions. And it still makes perfect sense. And we can still contemplate its goodness independently of all of these natural qualities. And what this means is that the concept of goodness itself, it's a unique concept that's exists outside of the physical properties of the cake itself, and that can't be boiled down to any specific property itself of the cake. And so Moore's point here is that if this concept exists independently outside of all of these properties, these physical properties, then it must exist outside of the thing itself, outside of human beings that we can latch on and that we can consider regardless of our preferences. What do you think about this? It's kind of a complicated, odd argument. Yeah. But
no, I get it, and I really like that.
Yeah.
So if I'm to think of like some morally abhorrent action, let's just say murder. Everyone almost universally agrees, I think, that the murder is wrong. So person A walks over to a rando in a mall and stabs them, and the person dies. We have some physical types of properties that we can talk about, right? You know, the motion, the movement of the person walking towards them, the knife itself, we could describe that, you know, the sticking it into the person's body. We can describe all these properties, right? So if we take all of those properties away, is it still morally wrong to do that? The answer is yes, I think. And it's not dependent necessarily on those properties. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think this goes to this question. Interestingly enough, this kind of concept of meaning, which exists outside of data, and goodness, I think, is part of that. We make sense of a thing's goodness outside of its qualities. And I know that you're not a big, and neither am I, but I know that you're not a big Jordan Peterson fan. But I think I heard this example that he made once, and I think this is something that he's right about, because I think he talks about meaning in some ways before he got into politics. And I think this is right. And so I think this is him, but don't, if this was somebody else, don't get upset. I'm sorry. Let's imagine this, this kid named Jimmy. Okay. And Jimmy is someone who's kind of like Spock. He really is deeply entrenched inside of the data of things, but can't really, he has no imagination. He can't really make up a story or a concept of things. And so Jimmy, he's a fifth grader. He comes home from school one day, and Jimmy's mom asks him, you know, Jimmy, how is school today? And Jimmy says, well, it was 82 degrees Fahrenheit at school. We read a bit of a book, and then we had nap time for 30 minutes. And then we went outside to play for 20 minutes. We played kickball. We scored 1 point. If we heard this, we would be like, and the mom, I think, appropriately is like, are you okay? Like, is everything okay with you? Because the data alone does not describe the meaning of a thing. And so
It's like, Jimmy, but did you enjoy school today?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was
exactly.
Kickball fun? These types of things, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then Jimmy might say in response, like, well, kickball, the ball was deflated by 3 foots of a degree. And we would look at Jimmy like, Jimmy, what the heck? Okay.
The data because... suggests.
Exactly. And so I think that there's concepts like goodness and meaning, which, yes, they might exist. Is this concept which human beings relate to and that human beings ascribe, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not independent of human beings, or they might be concepts themselves apart from the empirical and physical part of the world, which human beings can metaphysically connect with and value, unconnected from physical things of this world. Anyways.
Yeah. So kind of a question for the listeners is, where do you land here? Are you with Mackie?
Yeah.
Or are you with Moore?
Yeah. And how does that influence your the way that you think about the world? Because either sets of either position that you take, and I don't think this is one where you can really be neutral on a subject, which is which is interesting, they radically change how you can think about the world and how you exist in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things I like teaching about ethics and morality, is that it is very applicable to our lives. There's lots of really cool things in philosophy, like consciousness or something. And that's important too, you know, we can, because that's important, free will and things like that. But, you know, none of that really impacts our daily life.
That's right. Yep.
In the way that morality and ethics do.
This was one last comment I wanted to make about the last episode, but this discussion last week around the analytical tradition where we were...
Was I making jokes about it? I can't remember.
No. But I think there was this discussion, why do we limit aesthetics in philosophy?
Right.
And I have two things to say. I think the question is a little misguided. Is the analytical position wrong because it doesn't talk about the aesthetic tradition so much? I think we can still look at the aesthetic tradition in philosophy in an analytical frame. I think that just people don't want to right now. And so I don't think that's on its own as a hit against the analytical tradition. But I think in the same way, the analytical tradition uses these great tools to dissect these really complicated topics, as we've seen in this episode. And it has tremendous value because these things are so applicable. And so I think it makes sense. Like, this is a big question. It makes sense that our attention is on these issues, like ethics and political philosophy. They're big, big issues which impact how we think about the world. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, he was a great Supreme Court justice writer. He says that the world was influenced more by Kant than Napoleon from his ethical thinking. And I think that's true. Like, the way that we think about these radically change millions and billions of people's lives.
I mean, I absolutely agree. The analytical tradition, I think, go use the word best. It's best to try to approach these problems from. Now, I think maybe last episode my criticism was it's the analytical tradition dominates.
There's too many people. Yeah.
Yeah, you're dominates right. University instruction.
I think that's just true. But I think also there's a reason for that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. When I was still at Rice, I was talking to a graduate student at the time who was really upset about that. She was really wanted a program that was continental. And the sad fact is, like, the programs that are continental, just they don't have enough money. They don't pull good professors, and so the students who go there just are. I mean, not in all cases, right? But they're not able to compete. They're not able to compete in. Which is sad, but it's just the truth.
One of my criticisms for moral relativism is just not very satisfactory when it comes to trying to determine the rightness or wrongness. Because, you know, if I think that something is wrong and you think something is right, well, great. We have nothing that we can agree upon. My belief that it's right and your belief that it's wrong is in many ways are equal. There's no meaningful moral proposition that we can put forth. If you're just like, yes, Messe is the best. And I'm like, no, Messe is not the best. All we're saying there is like, I approve of messy, or rather you approve of messy, and I disapprove of messy. And that's all we're saying. And so, you know, when it comes to things like murder, you know, I say murder is wrong, and you say, oh no, murder is right in this case, you know. And really all we're saying is, well, we disagree with each other. And there's no satisfactory conclusion to those types of statements.
Ooh, that's right, yeah.
But anyway, yeah, that's one of my beefs with it. It's like, we've not concluded anything.
I prefer chicken, though.
Chicken, as opposed to what?
As opposed to beef.
Oh, I see. Well, depends on what you do with it.
Yeah, that's true. I cooked up a mean fajita yesterday.
Oh, man, I bet it was delicious. Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm a very awful cook. Do you want to do the book corner real quick, or do you want to...
Oh, yeah, let's do book corner. Is that what we call it? Bookshelf. No?
Bookshelf.
Bookshelf. Hey, let's head over to the bookshelf. Well, last episode we talked about Mr. Dennett, Daniel Dennett, the great American philosopher, passed away. So he came out with a memoir last year, and you know, his death inspired me to go ahead and purchase that. It was on my list. I hadn't gone to the trouble of purchasing it yet.
Yeah.
But anyway, I have it and I'm reading it. I'm about a third of the way through it. It's just really fascinating. Some things about him that I just certainly had no idea about, which, I mean, from everything from he was an incredible pianist. He also did sculpting, you know, all before, you know, he went to Oxford. And, you know, the list of luminaries, philosophical luminaries who he knew at Oxford is impressive. And, you know, I just didn't know those things.
Yeah.
So it's a really great book. He's a really good writer. And when I say good, what I mean is he's entertaining to read. I mean, it's an enjoyable thing to do. Reading, of course, is always enjoyable, but he's a captivating actor's like, no, he's a captivating writer. I also think that's probably one of the reasons he's one of the more well-known philosophers. Anyway, it's a good book. Check it out. It's Daniel Dennett. The title is I've Been Thinking.
Let's cut it. Let's end it.
Oh, you don't have a book you want to talk about?
Oh, no, I figure let's just leave it with you. I have one, but for next time. Yeah.
Okay.
You can check out my newsletter for a book review. How about that?
Yes, that's right. That's good. Yes. Hey, well, that's a good segue. Okay. Since you'll talk about the newsletter in the outro, that's a good time to say, hey, everyone, thanks for listening today. We really appreciate that you do. We know your time is important, and we always value that you have taken some of that time and spent it listening to us talk about pizza.
Absolutely.
Taylor's not here. Which one picks up Taylor's bit?
Uh-oh.
Rock, paper, scissors?
You go for it.
Okay, all right.
Hey, everyone. You're going to do half, and I'll do half? Yeah.
Oh, I don't know where the half... Yeah, I don't know where the line is in the half. You know, I don't know where to draw that.
I guess we just have to improvise some.
Yeah. I guess we will. We'll try half. Hey, everyone. Are you listening? We'd love to hear from you. So, give us your thoughts about the episode, ideas you thought were good, things that interest you, things that you feel like need some correction or clarification, or just send us random stuff for us to think about.
Yeah,
just give us a contact. We have an email, contact@opendoorphilosophy.com, and then you can also hit us up on Instagram. We are there as well.
Instagram. Yeah, Instagram. Great. And make sure also to go and sign up for our newsletter. You can do this anywhere we are, so just scroll down right now wherever you're listening and subscribe. It's great. Yeah, it's super fun. And send us an email and let you know what you think about the newsletter too. And if you subscribed, we will probably respond unless we get eaten by like a lion who's looking for an antelope. Okay.
We'll respond. Don't worry.
We'll respond. Hopefully. Yeah. Unless all humans disappear tomorrow, in which case I don't know why you are subscribing to our newsletter.
Yeah, you probably have better things to do.
Probably. Yeah.
But don't forget YouTube.
Also YouTube. Yeah, absolutely. So please subscribe to us on YouTube. We're having a lot of fun there, and you can see our faces.
Okay. See our faces. And you can, if you really feel like you need to see our faces,
you can try. Yeah, that's right. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. We enjoy listening. No. Okay,
we enjoy doing it. How about that?
Yeah, enjoy doing it. Absolutely. So we enjoy doing it, but I'll be glad for Taylor to come back next episode. I'm sure she'll be glad to be back from her wild school year. All right. Yeah. So remember, when your life is in need of some philosophy, the door is always open. Thanks.
Bye, guys.